Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? Welcome to day one of our holiday extravaganza here at Waypoint, our pantheon of good games. The year was shitty, but games were great, so great that we decided to take all of the characters and dress them up like gods and goddesses and spirits of justice and divine retribution and ghosts. I think there might be a ghost in there somewhere. We are here to kind of do as many things as we can to celebrate the good games of this year and talk about the major trends throughout the entirety of the gamosphere, the places where the world has broken in, and the places where games have been a refuge from everything on the outside. I'm Austin Walker, your host. Joining me today, Danielle Riendo.
Hello, how are you?
Tired. Somehow, this is the last podcast we decided to record in a string of five, plus the Friday podcast, plus a follow-up Monday podcast for the first. So despite this being the beginning of our holiday podcast, it's the last one we're recording. Also joining us, Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
How you doing?
Not too bad. Just trying to keep the energy level high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I'm fading. I'm fading. If only I had someone to back me up. Patrick, are you there?
Yeah, I'm eating these Annie's cheddar bunnies.
Those are delicious.
Wait, what?
What? Cheddar bunnies?
Annie's. Yeah, Annie's homegrown cheddar bunnies. They grow rabbits and then they chop them up and they turn them into crackers.
Yeah.
Danielle, you're a vegetarian. Why
hop,
do you
hop,
know how
hooray, I'm organic.
They are goldfish that are shaped like bunnies, but they're crackers. They're vegetarian.
So they're just goldfish.
They're goldfish, but they're organic.
Healthier goldfish.
Yeah, organic goldfish.
I'm looking at this webcam. I know y'all, this webcam isn't turned on or even plugged in, but I'm giving it a look right now.
And you should screenshot that. Screenshot your look.
But I'm not, the webcam is off. Nothing would.
What's wrong with my fucking bunny snack?
It's fine.
You can have a bunny
snack. I have
snack.
A child.
Yeah,
she eats the bunny. She eats the bunny snack,
and it's a cheddar bunny.
Yeah, it's a
this
cheddar
is
bunny.
My son.
I have a child, and it's a bunny, and it tastes like cheddar. What's wrong with
you? Yeah, the fuck off my back.
God,
give me what a Kronos to our,
I'll give
to
you
our
a
podcast.
Look.
Oh my God. Well, Patrick, Danielle, Rob, we are here today to talk about video games, which are interactive entertainment that you can play on a screen near you. Some of them don't even need a screen. You can close your eyes and use your ears. And those ones are hard because I'm bad at that. But today I don't think we're going to talk about any of those. We are going to talk about the games that did not make the cut on our personal lists, but that we thought were really good or at least worth talking about. Because otherwise,
take
I feel
that
like
games.
Because, I think that the actual thing is, today I wrote about, for the site, the feeling that there are too many games. I think this is a recurring thing probably from us all year because we have to cover them, and it felt like, okay, I'm just now going to get into this huge game that's really solid, and then like the next thing you know, you have to switch off to another new huge thing, or even you're overwhelmed with a lot of small things where, you know, oh, this is only 3 or 4 hours to play through, but that's a lot of time to devote to a small thing sometimes even, because there are so many 3 or 4 hour small things. Like, oh, do I want to spend today playing Tacoma? Do I want to spend it playing Night in the Woods? Do I want to spend it playing Doki Doki Literature Club or Dejana? Or like, I have a huge list of small games that I need to, I don't want to play through Observer. Do I want to play through like so many? And so today I wanted to kind of chop out a spot in the podcasts to talk about those games that maybe didn't make our top 10 list, but we still felt were really, really good. I just want to jump into it. Otherwise, it's going to hang over us.
Yeah.
Because the one that doesn't make my list, and I know this comes to great
taking a deep breath. Taking a deep
for
breath.
Danielle. Is Prey. Is Prey. Ah. Is Arcane Austin.
Is she, hold on. Before you get that. Danielle, she is expressing the same amount of exhaustion and like and mild anger that was given when we actually off mic revealed that it was not on a list. Like, so this is no drama.
This is not drama.
This is not this a reenactment. This is real. She was just as upset.
So pissed.
Yeah, which I know is a game that you really loved, Danielle.
Yes.
And I mean, I think if this podcast goes up the day I think it does, it will have been revealed that it'll just say very high on your list.
Oh, you can say it. This is going up the same day. Prey is my number one game of 2017. Game of the year.
And it's not on my list. And if I'm being fully honest, it could have been. Mm-hmm. And then I played a different game. I played Dishonored: Death of the Outsider, which helped focus my feelings on Prey such that it actually pushed my affection for Prey further away. Billy Lurk, let me just tell you, she gets up to some shit in a way that really was surprising to me, because I'd left Prey thinking, man, I really liked that game. I really liked half of that game, let's say, in terms of like the time that I put into it. But maybe I'm just growing less fond of these immersive sims. And then I played Death of the Outsider. And even though I'm more of a sci-fi guy than a fantasy guy, fantasy steampunk guy, I walked away from Death of the Outsider feeling like, oh man, I really actually still really love immersive sims. Prey just didn't do it for me as well. But I still think it's a great game. I still think it's a good game. And I still think that it deserves to be talked about here. So
can Daniel, I'm gonna let you finish? Can I do one?
I was finished actually. So I was about to throw to you.
See,
to
I'm say, too hey, polite you... for a true I'm gonna let you finish. All I was gonna say is that there can be room in your heart for both, because Death of the Outsider is my number three game.
There's room in my heart for both, but there's not room on my list for both. So,
oh God, yeah, that hurt. I had a physical reaction right there.
But like, let's talk through it, because this was a game that I think we all wrote about in the middle of the year. Yeah. We all played it, which is a rare thing. It's a rare thing that all four of us on this podcast will like play through an entire long game. Like, I put 40 hours into that fucking game. I don't want to rehash that conversation necessarily, but we've had some space now, and maybe we can talk about Prey a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well, first thing I'm going to say is I know Rob also really loves Prey and also has it pretty high on his list. So I'm glad that I'm not alone. I feel like I have some support here. Really glad. I'm glad we're drawing lines in the sand, as it were. Really, really honestly, for me, it was between Prey and Breath of the Wild for my number one spot.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I had to be just very honest with myself about what really, really, really did it for me. I think Prey is a phenomenal game. I think it is the best Bioshock by a wide margin. And there's evidence. Campster Errant Signal on YouTube has an interesting analysis where he thinks it should have been called Psycho Shock, because that really would have actually been more in keeping with the themes that it sort of purports to address, but I think it does it better than any Bioshock game. I think it does over-the-top immersive sim, not from the Thief lineage, but from the Shock lineage, really, really well. And I think it's not just the story works really, really well for me. I know that falls apart for a lot of people. I really like the way the story was approached, but for me, overall, it's level design and systems design and a sense of discovery that Prey does better than any other game this year, including Breath of the Wild. I think there are things in that game, the more time you spend with it, and I don't, I will also say this, I do not discount your opinion of not being wowed by a lot of Prey. I don't want to say, oh, I'm right. I'm acting like a baby a little bit because it's funny, but genuinely, I get it. And I also get annoyed when people say like, oh, you know, if you get through the first 50 hours, hour 702 is great. Like that's not a thing that I will ever say. I will say that the more time I spent with the game, the more I fell in love with it. I actually think it gets stronger as it goes, even with some faults. And I think there are a lot of things about Discovery in terms of its actual systems that absolutely delighted and surprised me even after spending like 80 hours with it. The fact that you could approach any problem in this game and not just from the sort of very, very, not binary, but very, you know, like there's five branches or something. There's five, mm-hmm. you know, the Deus Ex kind of approach of there's five ways to approach this problem. There's more like 52 ways to approach any given problem. And a lot of them are not going to be something you understand until far, far later in the game. You can use small objects in the environment in a really weird and interesting way. You can actually blow open passageways using things like oxygen canisters and all kinds of stuff. There mm-hmm. are useless weapons in the game that are not actually useless. You just use them in this very puzzly MacGyver kind of solution sort of way. A lot of the fun I had in Prey after sort of doing the entire main story and the sort of main quest were really just messing around, using it as sort of a puzzle box and being delighted by how much leverage I could get from just playing around, just experimenting, just doing different things.
Yeah, I definitely, I feel like I enjoyed a lot of that puzzling around. And I think the things that stick out for me are, like, I think that the story is fantastic. I really love the fiction of the world. I think that the characters, the main characters of that story are all really strong. And there's a lot of work to be done in looking at how they characterize them and how they communicate character motivation to you, especially.
Yeah.
But there is, the thing that holds it off my list is, partially is the length, and the lack of, or not the lack of, but comparatively to Death of the Outsider, which is meant to be a much smaller game, but the focus, which there are, I guess, a couple ways you can think about focus. On one hand, I don't mean that I'm glad that their Death of the Outsider's problems only have three or four solutions compared to Prey's dozen or whatever. I think that is a strength of Prey, especially when you start thinking about character builds and, you know, weapon modifications and all that other stuff that, you know, there's a kind of a second layer of, I've already made a choice. That means I can't use X. Like the first time you played through, you didn't use any alien powers, right?
Right.
So, like, that's all, that's a whole other meta layer of choice there. But I do mean that I think that there is, it took me 40 hours to get through Prey, I think, and I would cut half of those away. I would cut away all of the times I spent, like, staring at my map, not understanding how the weird tube that connects the whole space station
goes. Oh, the guts.
The guts suck. They, like, and I don't mean, they're bad. They're bad. I don't say that often, but, like, my experience of them was so frustrating as to take me away from anything I was enjoying about that game. And I mean anything, which is to say, like, I don't even think the story bits that are communicated in that space are necessarily good. I also think it's, like, one of the first times that I started to dislike the enemy design in terms of just pure visual design. Like, I, one of the things that works so well for me in immersive sims is how much I love playing with enemies. I love mm-hmm. recognizing what their patterns are. I love trying to intuit what they're thinking, even though they're not thinking anything, and in fact are just kind of automatons that have a pattern or that have responses pre-programmed into them. And I like feeling like a cat playing with a mouse, right? And having that flipped on me and suddenly being the prey that's being chased down. But in Prey, I never had either of those feelings because I didn't really relate to the character designs, the enemy designs very well. I think none of the designs outside of the Mimic, who I think is a brilliant design. It's like it's a fantastic enemy that makes you feel very paranoid for the first like 6 hours of that game until you have the powers you need to just completely ignore them forever. the rest of those enemies just like did so little for me, and I never really felt like I had that specific sequence of engagement with them. Even the most powerful enemies who could scare me, I knew how to get out so quickly or to get to a point of safety so quickly that the only times that I was ever really threatened, which is weird in a game called Prey, is when literally they locked the door behind me and in front of me and they put me in a single room with two of the strongest enemies in the game. And so, like, this, what would have let Prey sneak onto my list, I think, is for it to have been 25 hours, for it to have gotten to the crew quarters quicker, which is where you start to meet all the characters, meet in quotation marks here, right? Like, you start to read about and listen to the stories of the characters, of the bulk of the crew that made up the station, Talos Station, Talos 1, is that what it is?
Yeah.
and they have really interesting lives, and there's so much stuff that is so good there about this science fiction setting. Obviously, we've talked before about the nerds playing D&D in space, and about the queer romance in space, and about the betrayals, and about the paranoia. About, like, there's so many characters who even now I think about the pianist who goes up. Like, there's so many cool characters there, but you don't get any of that for so long, and there's this hefty middle chunk that just... I get why people don't like games like this. Like, Prey, if this is so, I'm someone who likes immersive sims. And when I played Prey, there was 15 hours in the middle that I just would have cut completely out. How must people who don't naturally go towards immersive sims have felt about that? And in some regards, this to me is why I don't have the reverence for BioShock that I once did, certainly. Sure. Outside of I have it in small chunks. I can say, oh, this level design was really good, but I haven't played it all the way through in years, and so I'm cautious by saying about making claims about it. But what I do know is it was accessible in a way that brought a bunch of people into the genre. And I'm not going to argue that every one of these games should be accessible, but if we want to know why the immersive sim is dying, it's because they're often made for people like you and me and not for people who might be listening to this podcast and who are saying, like, I really wanted to get into Dishonored, but the blink power seems so hard to use quickly. And it's like, well, I wish that the way Dowd's blink in the first DLC, where it pauses the world and lets you, like, look around and choose where to go to, was just the default in that game. And, like, if my argument is anything, it's like, please make the 20-hour Prey. Please make the Prey that has 30 different options for how to get into a room or whatever, but also empowers the players who would not naturally come to this sort of game to feel like they can get through it and enjoy it, even when the combat is also I think the combat is bad in Prey, but even when it falls into combat, it just doesn't feel good. Like, in a purely physical way, like, I don't like getting into gunfights, and also, I just wish the enemy design was just more interesting for me visually, because you fight, there are so many of those aliens, and I wish there was maybe, I wish that the something like the mimic was, I had another mimic moment in that game in the later half, and I was just waiting for it, and it never came. I still think it's a great game, but that is why I did not make my top 10.
Okay.
I,
Trying not to cry.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, what I'll say sort of in defense of Prey, like, when I think about, like, the things that would keep me from putting Prey on my list, immediately, like, I get a picture in my mind of the guts.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I, like of literal passages within that endless fucking space crawl space, basically. That you get stuck in, and they fill it with their least engaging enemy type, the Weaver.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is cool when you foresee it, because it's kind of the thing that's, like, changing the environment. It's kind of, like, it's a harbinger
it's
of
a
what's
cool
happening.
It's a great effect. Yeah.
Yeah, and seeing the these threads of coral taking over the station, and the fact that it's starting to feel more and more alien, that's all cool. The Weaver sucks as an enemy.
Yeah.
So does the Nightmare, for that matter. They're yep. big super boss. It's too big to fit in most spaces, so
and
you end up just,
big-
like...
It's also too big to discern characteristics from it in a memorable way. In the way that, like, when I think about Big Daddies, I can immediately paint them in my mind. The Nightmare is a blob of it's like a humanoid black blob of ink, and like, I want more definition.
And I think it hurts Prey that Prey has like shows its best ideas within the first 2 hours, and then.
I think the last two, or the last five or something also. I really do think that it closes fairly strong, even if it shows its narrative.
I agree,
hand.
But I think it closes strong on a thematic level.
Yeah.
Not in
totally.
Terms of, like, just the, like, mechanical novelty
right.
Of the opening hours. But I think what ends up redeeming it for me is that once it is shown what this game is truly about, a lot of the things that I noticed about it that felt odd... all started to make sort of a thematic sense, right? Like, it was an experience that the more, like, as the game started to, like, unveil its end game, the meaning of the experience I'd had started to change and evolve, like, in my memory. Like, I was starting to, like, it changed my appreciation of what had come before. But I think what I loved the most about Prey, and it's a thread running through a lot of my top 10, actually, is it just feels like a very now game. Like, so a few years ago, there's a bad movie that Brad Bird made, Tomorrowland.
Oh, God, yes, I reviewed that. Yeah.
It's a shitty movie. which is disappointing, because I think Brad Bird's a good director, but, man, like, Tomorrowland just sucks. But the ways it sucks are instructive. Like, Tomorrowland opens with this kind of provocative idea, you know, George Clooney kind of asking, like, well, what happened to the future? Right? Like, where did the idea of progress and the possibility of science and engineering and discovering new worlds and, you know, meaningful, like, exciting progress that would turn the world into a place of wonder, where did that go? Why did that future end up getting derailed? And what causes that movie to fall apart is that its vision of the future is literally the fucking Tomorrowland section of Disneyland. It's all just like, you know, it's jetpacks and Rocket Age bullshit, and has like no real awareness of, you know, how progress has been utilized historically or where it tends to lead. What I like about Prey, though, is that it feels like it takes place in the world that generated dreams like that. You know what I mean? It feels like the sort of the feeling that people in the atomic age or the rocket age, whatever you want to call it, the idea they had of the track that they were on, it feels like that all came true. They got to their destination. And with Talos One and throughout all of Prey, you see the ways that has been subverted and twisted, you know, by capitalism, you know, by avarice, by greed, and then the various ways that humans trapped within that system have sort of been compromised by it. And I can't, like, I'm always up for that kind of story. And I think Prey ends up telling it really, really well. I love that aesthetic, but I love even more the way it smartly uses that aesthetic and sort of the associations it carries, the meanings it carries, in a really clever way to talk about where we're at now, historically. So, yeah, like, I agree, the monster design does suck, but, you know, the pleasure I took in other areas far outweighed it.
Yeah, I think that is fair. I think that is totally fair. At the end of the day, that is, like, how these lists work is what is it that made me think the most, made me happiest, made me moved me the most this year. So I think that is a fair and just argument from both you and Danielle. Still not going to make it on my list, unfortunately. But please know that I'm repping the immersive sim as many times as I can honestly and truthfully do it on my list. That's mine. That took up a lot of time. Patrick, what's yours? Maybe yours will be quicker.
Let's see. Try to think of the one I feel the worst about. yeah. Like, I got options. I got plenty of options that are not no one else's list. You're the ones that are, like, specifically cut. Like, I have the cut list. Like, Golf Story, like, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's cut from mine also. I didn't finish it, but I did cut it.
It has a bad last, like, 6 hours. Okay. Evil Within 2, really enjoyed that game.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised that didn't make the cut.
I tried really hard to find a way. It's a game that's, you know, again, like in the top 15. Horizon Zero Dawn, also one of that in my top 10. Night in the Woods, I got cut.
Yeah.
Observer, which was cut for Doki Doki Literature Club, Dream Daddy.
Ooh.
Huh.
Cutting cyberpunk for anime. I think Danica said that in her chat at some point. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Patrick Klepek.
Crypto weeb.
God.
Prey, Gravity Rush 2. I think the one that I feel the worst about.
I should have said Gravity Rush 2. Fuck.
Yeah, no, yeah. That's, yeah.
Gravity Rush 2 still might make it. I'm going to look at my list. Go ahead, keep talking.
Because we talked a little bit about our reservations about that game on some podcast, maybe on the one
recently. Yeah, yeah.
I think the one that I know is not any. Well, maybe Stories Untold. Did that end up on anyone else's list?
No,
I liked it a lot, but it did not
tell
make
me
the
about
list. Yeah,
that game because I think I watched Danica, Joel, and Danielle play it.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Tell me, but I don't remember. I wasn't actually watching. I was doing work in the room, so I was only half watching, and they got real scared a couple times.
Our lights actually went out. like a thing. Okay. Or no, somebody opened the door right when there was like a very dramatic moment. That's right. You were working. Okay. Yeah. I remember.
What? Tell me about this game, Patrick.
Well, I mean, I remember when I wrote about it earlier this year, and this one will be a lot quicker than Prey, is that it tries to reimagine the context in which you drop sort of like a text adventure. Like a lot of the game primarily involves you interacting with a terminal in which you are asking questions or using verbs and things like that to sort of move through a story. But like for the game opens with this taking place in an Apple II type computer, I believe, that you find in like the room of the house that you used to live in. And as things are happening, so you have like this computer monitor that's an old school, crappy little computer, but around it is like a highly detailed, 2017 like visualization of the room, right? So like the room that you're in, like has like, like really good lighting and models and the sound is everything you would expect from a game that was made, in a modern context. And so that's wrapped around a adventure game. And it just does a really, I think when we talked about it in the past, I'm not sure if it was on a podcast or not, like Danielle had pointed out how the game doesn't like hold up as well. And like, I think there's four stories.
I think there's four.
Something like that. And it's much stronger in the first half than the back half, although I seem to remember it finishing strong. But like what it attempted to do and what I think it accomplished was like a really interesting, instructive way of, because in the same way that, in a different podcast where I talked about visual novels and some of the hang-ups people have about why they do or don't get into them, I think as cool as Twine is, as cool as, like, text adventures are, I think the format itself is prohibitive to some people even giving it a chance because it is looked at as something that is either archaic or just weird or whatever the case. Like, I think there's something about it that for some people is deeply appealing as a format, and I think for other people the way it is presented, like the presentation of it, stops people from getting into it. I think Stories Untold says it looks at it as a presentation problem and says, what if like we wrap the text adventure around something else that feels a little more modern, and we use audio and visual stuff around the text adventure to make it seem like a much more intense sort of AV experience. And I think in that respect, it does like a really tremendous job, because I think the game is at its best when it is taking an older format. I guess even older is like, like Twine updates it for, the monitor, but like what is generally looked at to be an older format for interacting with a story and combines it with some of the advantages that you get in modern storytelling and modern technology. And I think it the stories would not be as strong if you separated it from that second component. And so it made a very interesting experience to go through that way. And I'd highly recommend more people go back and check that out. I'm hoping they've said that it was successful enough. They're going to like do another set of stories, because I think the foundation they've set with their experiment is really ripe for them to do some cool stuff. And yeah, it was a game that in any other like a lesser year, that is in my list really easy. Same with games like Observer. It was just sort of like, okay, like I just have to make some tough calls. And so Stories Untold is the one that I think Evil Within 2, both those I feel the worst about because I liked them so much, but them's the breaks. I already cheated once with my list. So.
Can't cheat. No cheating twice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting partially because this is maybe the third or fourth year in a row that we've seen a game in the interactive fiction space at least somewhat break through. Years ago, we had 80 Days breakthrough. I think her story is in that field, even though 100%. It has FMV. But like that, Sam Barlow is an IF creator and that design is kind of an IF design. And obviously, I think just visual novels in general have had a really great renaissance in the West in terms of finding an audience. But these like traditional interactive fiction parser-based games or hypertext games. I mean, like obviously we can go back further than that to the years that Twine kind of came on the scene.
Mm.
And everyone was talking about Howling Dogs, you know, as one of their games of the year. It was not everyone, but there was a subset of critics, certainly, who were looking at the work of Twine creators and being really excited about it. And it's interesting to see something like Stories Untold try to find this audience, and partially do it by packaging it really nicely, right? By saying, how can we dress up what is fundamentally just interactive fiction, not mm-hmm. just, but is interactive fiction, for an audience who would say that isn't a video game, and keep them engaged. And how can we draw on, I mean, in their case, they draw on like a history of horror and a history of like 1980s Lovecraft. Stuff, Lovecraft, like, and also just like the visual parts of that storytelling, especially in, so there's like multiple stories. Right?
Yes.
Inside of it. And they take place in different like rooms. It's not just that one main room.
Entirely different settings, even. Not yeah. just different rooms. There's like labs and other right. kinds of settings.
There's yeah. just, it's an anthology series that yeah. uses the first right. and fourth or third story, whatever it is, like to sort of like loop back around. Like essentially like the right. the opener functions as like the crypt keeper for like Tales, you know, from yeah, the crypt, yeah. like it, that sort of right. thing.
I saw, and I can't find it now. I was trying to find it quickly, but I saw some conversation from the interactive fiction scene in the last like 2 or 3 weeks about whether or not IF could have a big breakthrough because of these games. And one of the things that, was being debated or talked about was whether or not, the fact that these games were reliant on these like this packaging to bring people in was going to keep IF in general out of reach, because most people who make interactive fiction don't get to dress it up by putting it in the mm-hmm. the clothing of let's say a Sunless Sea, right, which also is an IF game that's dressed up as and has some degree of like tactical resource management stuff going on.
Well, Night in the Woods too.
Night in the Woods
is made in yarn. Like I'm using right. the tool that they used right. to make a little thing of my own. It's very much it's like twine. Yarn is like a twine-like, basically, right. thing. All the text right. in that game is made in that
totally.
Fashion.
Yeah. And so I think it's an interesting thing where, on one hand, part of the argument that I saw was like, well, interactive fiction games back in the day used to ship with feelies, with fake newspapers and fake props from space stations, and used to have, you know, there were all sorts of things that helped you transport yourself into that space and time and world, right? Like, not every one of these games did this, but there were lots of, you could get boxed copies of interactive fiction games that then also communicated something via, you know, you would transform your desk into the room in a sense, right? But then I also get the notion that, like, yes, Night in the Woods is primarily a game with text, but it doesn't feel like interactive fiction, really. It feels like maybe like a visual novel, but with some platforming, but it doesn't feel like parser-based fiction. It doesn't feel like a Twine game, even. It feels somehow like some, like a different thing. I don't think any of this is bad. It's just something to think about. Like, I'm curious if 2018 will be a year where we get another one of these that finds a large audience. Or if instead what we'll see is more games like Night in the Woods, which maybe have their roots in interactive storyteller, in IF, interactive fiction, crossing over and becoming more and more like platformers, more and more like exploration-based games, walking simulators, etc.
You know? I think that's you know, similar what we might end up seeing with the immersive sim, right? It was like that was right. that same conversation was like, you know, the sales performance of a bunch of immersive sims in 2016 and 2017 suggests that there's going to have to be some sort of pivot, but like that doesn't necessarily mean that you lose the values of those games. It's just that maybe there's a way of contextualizing, not even just presentations, like the context, the lessons of different genres and different approaches to games then get put in a different box that you can get a similar vibe, a similar feel. It's just kind of like put together in a different skeleton.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm, like I said, curious to see what comes next in this whole genre of things, especially, as additional platforms like itch.io, kind of finally stabilize a little bit and become places where developers are able to put out their games to audiences. Like, those are the places where I hope to see more of that stuff and more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Development. Rob and Danielle, you both have to go. I realize, Danielle, we spoke a lot about Prey, but you did not have a game yet that was not on your list.
I mean, which I have one, but Rob, you can go first. That's fine. I can end it.
yeah, I think for me, so a game that I really admired a lot, and I kind of just want to talk about it here at the end of the year, even though actually it was not as close to breaking the top 10 as it might be implying. But when I think about games that I wish I could have like singled out a little more here at the end of the year, Afghanistan 11 from Every Single Soldier
for us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like one of your first pieces for us, actually.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the sort of shit I want to see more of, but like not quite like this. And what it is, it's a war game about the conflict in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to get at certain dynamics of that war. It's a solitaire war game. There is no controlling like the Taliban side, because it's so asymmetrical. Like their side is not even modeled except as like an abstract enemy that is there to continue like annihilating your victory conditions. But it's a really interesting and like thought-provoking game because basically like. It tries to cover a couple really important dynamics of the war. One is that the terrain in Afghanistan is incredibly difficult. That you know, good road routes are almost non-existent in large parts of the country, particularly those parts of the country where you're going to actually be fighting. And so a lot of the war is carried on by using air mobile tactics and like fire bases in hard to reach places. But that also means that those forces become extremely vulnerable, that fighting the Taliban effectively means pushing your forces deeper and deeper into territory that is not necessarily hostile, but can like turn hostile very, very quickly. And then the other aspect of this is, you know, you're fighting a very casualty averse war. And so what you want to do is spot the enemy and then call in airstrikes, but never actually like have infantry duking it out, in a valley. Cause like, then you might lose forces. And that's a disaster, right? Like attack and fight and destroy a ton of Taliban targets and they'll keep coming back. But like, if you lose one of your units, it's a pretty massive, setback and a pretty serious disaster, for you as a commander. And then the final thing it tries to bring out is that the American forces are theoretically going to go away. That
right.
In each scenario, the province you're fighting over, yeah, the war starts out with the US led coalition being there and fighting with, you know, Apache gunships, you know, MRAPs, which are basically impervious to mines, you know, really advanced, you know, really well-trained infantry with lots of, like, aerial resources to call upon. But toward the end of the scenario, those units need to be withdrawn, and the fighting needs to be taken over by Afghan National Army forces, which are all basically identical to your forces, except they're, like, one click lower on the quality setting. So like they don't have MRAPs, they have armored vehicles, but like they take some damage from mines, but not as much, right? Whereas MRAPs can just sort of drive over them. They have helicopters that are pretty good, but they're not like, you know, the death from above that the Apache helicopter
right.
is. And so in the last part of the scenario, you lose all your best troops, and now you really kind of have to hold on using the Afghan forces you've spent a lot of the game building up. And then you just kind of have to ride out, you know, the end of the scenario, trying to sort of keep the Taliban in check, keep your listening posts supplied, you know, keep your recon forces out there, keeping an eye on the countryside. And it's really, really good. Like, it's all really clever. It's really demanding. There's a lot here that I admire. The problem is that it's kind of got nothing beyond that trick, right? Like, it has this design. It works. It's really demanding. It's cool. It's novel. And then it has all these scenarios where you just apply those same dynamics again and again and again and again. And they all kind of start to feel very samey after a while. And then the other aspect of it is it's a cool way of representing the war in Afghanistan. But it also definitely feels like sort of a construct of, like, how we, like, what's the way to put this? We don't know how to win in Afghanistan. Fundamentally, we don't. Like, if we did, things would be going differently, right? Like, if this game plan represented in this game actually produced, like, sustainable, you know, positive results for the war effort in Afghanistan or for the Afghan government and the people living under its rule, then the situation there would be different.
Right.
But that's not really happening. And you can say, well, maybe that's partly political will, that the war is under-resourced. But also there is an operational and strategic element of, like, there are things we are trying to do that have not worked in, like, 15 years. Right. And this game is about,
that's what,
like,
you want to see more of. Like, that sort of systemization of problems that most games in the genre would present as fundamentally solvable through cleverness, right? Through better application of resources. And what Afghanistan 11, based on what you're describing, seems to say is no. There is a fundamental disconnect between how we approach problems like this, problems, quote unquote, like this, and the problems themselves, the situation itself. Like, there is no winning that war given any of the resources, given any of the playbooks that achieves the goal that we are setting out, that we claim to be setting out to achieve in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think, you know, from Bruce Garrett, this is a sequel to a game they made called Vietnam 65.
Okay.
And I think, you know, my friend Bruce Garrick, who's a much more serious war gamer than I am, mm-hmm. With a much deeper grounding in that field and in military history, the comment he made on Vietnam 65, and I think it applies here as well, is that Vietnam 65 is mm-hmm. a war game about the war that the U.S. Army thought it was fighting up until Tet.
Right.
And I think this is what's happening in Afghanistan, is, like, it is modeling the mindset that sort of gave us counterinsurgency operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, mm-hmm. particularly Afghanistan, in the mid to late 2000s. But then it doesn't actually have any sort of, like, prescriptive critique, which is understandable because, like,
right.
if you're making a game about, like, being a frontline commander, you know, trying to stabilize and sort of, like, quote unquote, solve these situations, there's actually nothing in your tool set. It's not within your purview to right. address the real underlying dynamics that are generating the situation. So you sort of have to abstract it away and say, like, look, if things are still good by turn 60, you win. Congratulations. Afghanistan is solved. But nevertheless, it is kind of like the, you know, it's the thing that I think ultimately makes Afghanistan 11 kind of unsatisfying, is that in addition to it being really repetitive in how these strategic dynamics play out, after a certain point, it just starts to increasingly nag at you that it just still feels like too simplified.
Right, right. It is a war we've been in for 16 years, and that shows no sign of stopping. And I think that makes it a difficult, that fact alone makes it a difficult thing to render into game, especially when we think about games and war games specifically as things that can be won. I mean, this is the thing that makes me think of, there was an article that was just going around recently again, about the games. It was Naomi Klein, Metasynthy, on Twitter, mm-hmm. Who linked out a piece about the game Spent, which I think I've mentioned this piece before, which is a game about surviving poverty. Yeah. And it was, you know, ostensibly supposed to teach you how hard it was to live as someone who is under the poverty line in America, who, you know, how expensive it is to be poor. And the piece was reflected a study done with the game that revealed, in fact, that of the people who played it, a number of them left the game less sympathetic to those under the poverty line, God. Believing that poverty was something you could win, right? Like, hey, just make the smarter decision. And so the as always, walking into this space of, you know, serious games or games that tackle these sorts of issues, I'm not saying all war games are serious games by any means, but the serious games is a subgenre of game. Google serious game if you want to get at what I'm getting at. But I think it's interesting to see this, the dilemma of how to represent dilemmas as games, and especially ones that have real political, material, physical, personal, human costs. I hope we get more games like that, and I hope that they correct in the way that you would like, Rob. Danielle, what is the game that did not make your top 10 list? And then this is our final, you get to close us out here.
Oh, you're going to love this.
Prey.
Right. No! No! Not Prey.
She cut it so we could talk about it for another 30 minutes.
Cut it, then put it back in number one where it belongs. Yeah. No, this one, honestly, I'm going to get a lot of hate mail for this. I'm going to get a lot of hate tweets. I'm going to get a lot of hate. Nier Automata. Okay.
I don't think you're going
to hate. It is not, and it is not because I don't think it's a good game. And I do need to play more. I'm going to start with that. Yeah. I'm starting with those. And I'm not pooing on anybody's opinions that thinks this is a great game. Here is my experience with Nier. I played the first section under the tutelage of my anime life coach. She was there with me. She supported me through it. So I played that first kind of section. And then I watched her play it for a couple of hours.
Can you explain what first section means?
The tutorial, I guess. The first 90 minutes.
Not the first ending.
Right.
No. Just... Okay. Yeah. And I watched her play it for a couple of hours. Subsequently, like a month or two later, I watched my girlfriend play pretty much the entire thing. So I have seen, I think, just about everything. She did at least four or five endings, I think. Maybe there's another one to go, yeah. But I have experienced much of this game. And again, I do plan on experiencing it fully by myself. Yeah. So, I think it's very interesting. I think it's very, very interesting. I'm there for sad robots. I definitely have seen a lot of like really heart-wrenching scenes in this game. I have witnessed a lot of incredibly sad robots in some really sad situations. I've seen a lot of funny things. I've seen the robots trying to do a sex. I've definitely seen that.
They sure tried. Yep. So you kind of had a sad or a
God.
Funny?
Yeah.
That scene.
Which is that sad or funny? Which one did you put that in?
That one was funny. You know, I put that under kind of funny. Sometimes emotions are complicated. You can feel sad and be laughing at the same time. It's fair. True. It's very fair. True.
I feel like
true.
This is turning into a Voight Kampf.
I know, right?
You see two robots.
Humping.
They are making sexual gestures at each other.
Are you sad?
Are you sad?
Are you laughing?
Yeah.
Can this continue?
Is this supposed to tell if I'm a robot or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard. Sorry. It wasn't British robot or lesbian. It was replicant.
Catherine Hepburn play.
Catherine Hepburn as Rachel. I can see it.
I would watch the shit.
A little bit. Yeah. All right.
Catherine Hepburn.
The hair. Uh-huh.
She has
know?
The hair. Yeah, totally. Totally.
Anyway, genuinely curious about this game, but that is all I kind of feel about it. I feel like I've seen, and maybe this was the wrong way to do it. This is just how my life goes sometimes. Sometimes I watch a whole lot of games. I watched pretty much all of Horizon Zero Dawn and pretty much all of Persona 5 as well, because my girlfriend also plays a lot of games and plays them to 100% a lot of the time. So I've witnessed it all. And
I think
felt
the over-the-shoulder thing pretty much counts for me.
Yeah, right? I think there are some games in which you could make the argument that like there is something intrinsic to
feel it,
playing
yeah.
it. But I don't like. There's no world where I'm like, shit. The gameplay was like the reason that game was incredible. Like I think the combat is fine, is serviceable. I tell most people just ratchet it down to easy, because even the interesting parts about the combat like get really repetitive at like you know hour 25. Like it just the combat
The story has more to say. The combat tree ran out of things to do for you as a player. But I think Nier is a game that either like grabs you or it doesn't. Because like that's essentially the response I've seen from I've seen very few sort of milquetoast response to the game.
Sure.
It's kind of interesting. It's more just like it just didn't do it for me. Or you have people like me who are trying to shake people into playing the game. You need to play it and you need to play it all the way to the end. But if it doesn't connect after the first one, I don't think any three is going to change anything.
Three might, but no. Continue. You're right. You're right.
But I'm not going to tell someone. But I think there is enough in the turn that endings is wrong. Chapters, right? The way that Nier works is it's perspective changes that largely happen when you're finishing, and it's if you don't find the turn that happens after the first ending. There's either a moment where you go,
that?
Yeah. I need to see everything this game wants to say, or you go, oh, okay, that's interesting. I just think it either grips you at that moment and then just continues to, turn the vice, more and more and more. Because I've seen another, Steve Kim Fobwash, another person who was I don't fucking get it. What is everyone? I think... This is one of those, and the reason which you should not apologize is because, in the same way that your response to Prey, it is somewhat emotion. It is emotion based, right? The reason I feel so strongly about Nier is because of the emotional response it provoked in me about the story it was telling and the stories of the characters in there. And that is somewhat for you too in Prey. It is not just that you really like the systems in that game, but it's the systems stacked on top of a world and characters with that movie. What that game is saying that makes it so emotionally powerful for you. So then the emotional response you have to the game is tied into your emotional response to how other people feel or don't feel about that game. And so I'm not shocked that you have that sort of reaction when maybe Prey's not on our top 10 list. And then you feeling like you need to apologize for a game that other people have been going, this is one of the best games of all time. I think it is one that either connects or doesn't, and that doesn't say anything about someone if Nier doesn't work for you. It's more just that's how stories work.
That's how stories work.
True.
Yep.
That's totally. True. I put that caveat on there because of the fact that a lot of it was that secondhand experience.
There
are games, but
Breath of the Wild is a game that would be kind of weird to say a lot of things about if you hadn't played it. But it's. There are very, and even that, I don't
even
know. There
that,
are few, there are few,
I think it's
there are few get, games that like
getting over it maybe is a game where you have to feel the failure of falling off this fucking cliff, or you have to feel how weird it is to swing this hammer. But even Hitman was on my list last year and I didn't play it until this year, and I fucking love that game.
Yeah,
I thought about putting it on my list this year, but it turned out we had a really fucking good. That's the other thing about this year is this is a really fucking good year for games, and games that would have made my list a year ago or 2 years ago aren't this year because I could fill it with so many other things I feel so strongly about. And Nier is one of those things. And I think one of the biggest bummers for me is how what the conversation around Nier has been in the last month as we hurtle towards Game of the Year stuff. The thing that shook forward and shook through and kind of filtered through the old the sieve is that game is horny. And I'm not saying that game has no horny in it. That game has some horny in it, right? You can with all of your characters self-destruct, blowing away your clothes to reveal your hot ass.
Is that sad or funny?
That's
Voitkov. Yeah.
It's sad. It's actually, so here's the thing. It's sad because unlike something like Quiet in Metal Gear Solid 5, who needed to be completely naked the time so that she could breathe through her skin, I guess. I didn't finish that game. I didn't get to that cutscene in that game.
I think you're right. I think that's what it was.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it was, to use her ability, or just to breathe in general. The characters in Nier, one, are not naked all the time, and in fact normally are wearing really rad, coolly designed outfits, but are constantly always, struggling with the fact that they know, to some degree, they were designed to be like people, and what does it mean to be a person, and what does it mean to be sexy? That's why those robots are fucking, is because, like, that entire species of robot are, like, walks through the entire range of human activity, from, you know, trying to build amusement parks and pine for lost lovers to
using makeup.
Using makeup, right? To building whole religions and faiths, to trying to establish weird, you know, communes in the woods. Every time that you encounter them, and then later, as you think through the androids you're playing as, and as you track what their story is, everything ends up being this second level conversation that isn't just, are robots people? It's like, what the fuck are people? And right. That, to me, is the thing that...
See, I dig keeps... that. I dig yeah, that so that, much. That's why part... I'm a little like, I don't know if yeah, if I missed yeah. something important or, you know...
I mean, that's...
Because I there like in... that stuff. I am there yeah. for that stuff, you know?
My So this is, I guess, that is the other thing, is maybe there is an argument for not I'm not dismissing your thing saying, because you didn't play it, you didn't like it as much. Or sorry, I'm not dismissing your thing saying, I'm not saying because you didn't play it, right. your opinion doesn't count. I think right. your opinion completely counts. I will say that playing that game at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. and, like, finishing the quest, a quest that reveals that one of these androids has been manipulating another one of these androids, not the side quest I'm talking about here, has, you know, been manipulating and rewriting one of their memories over and over and over again to try to get the outcome she wants. Like, ah, fuck. And that hits you a certain way when you're the one playing it alone in your bedroom at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And that isn't to, again, that isn't to say that your response to it is invalid. But it is to say that maybe one of the reasons this game hit for me so well is because I was playing it overworked in the late hours of the night in 2017 alone. And that so much of this game is about that feeling of being alone. And I don't just mean in the lowercase a sense. Like, it's a game that says, fundamentally, in the world, in the universe, none of us can connect. None of us can ever really reach out and touch another person. At all points, that connection is mediated by language or by technology or by physical distance or by the words that we refuse to say to one another because we're scared to, or by the words that we are compelled to say to one another because of loyalty or because of anger. And that all connection is impossible. And also, it's all we can fucking do to try to connect to each other. It's the only thing we can't stop trying to do, is find that deep human connection. No matter, you know, whether or not we were born as human or stumble into being it, like, that is the thing that makes us people, is trying to connect. And the biggest tragedies are when we fail to. And that hit me this year in a way that I didn't expect, because I went into it thinking it would be a horny game about androids. And it wasn't. And so, like, or to the degree that it was horny, it's horny because also it's true about humans that we are horny. And so, yes, that's in there. And it's true about the creators of that game that they are horny. Right. And so, yes, 2B has an ass. And, like, yes, I think that there are some scenes in that game that are gratuitous. But, like,
yeah, not all of it can be hand waved by the game's
themes. But the horniest scene in that game is when one character, like, sees another character wounded and starts to choke him to death. And, like, because it's her saying, this is how much I care for you, and I'm going to do this thing that is unbelievably terrible, because in this moment, my shield is down. I've stopped insulting you. I've stopped refusing to call you by the pet name you wish I'd call you. It's fantastic. And that stuff is so deeply human in a way, and melodramatic and operatic, and, like, all of these things that are, like, it's anime as fuck. Like, it is one of the most anime. Also, there are big mechs in this game named Marks and Engels. Like, also, this is a game, you know, like, straight up, there are. There's so much in Nier Automata that is held together with this strand of vision that I don't think comes from just one person, because it comes together through the music and through the character design and through, like, we give Yoko Taro a lot of credit, and I think we should, because it is a game that feels like it was touched by a director, but it also just feels like the team was aligned with this sense of sadness, but also the sense of hope. And I think Nier just earned a higher spot on my fucking list than at the start of this conversation.
Hell
so,
yeah.
Nier's climbing up that there, fucking Nier. List. Yeah.
Get up and near.
Get up and near. Great. Perfect. I think that's it. I think we've all talked.
Hold on. What's
up?
Breaking news. One part of our podcast have already been invalidated. When we did, I don't know where this is going in the weeks, but one of our podcasts involves Danielle talking about the game she's most looking forward to in 2018, which is no longer coming out in 2018.
No!
Are you fucking kidding me?
Psychonauts has already been delayed to 2019.
I knew it. Oh my God.
Man. It's
extremely good. I was I was quietly cackling when I saw it.
Do you want to just name drop another thing you're interested in? We don't have to get into it deep.
It's okay,
but...
Vampire. I said it. There should be another thing on there, right. But yeah, Vampire was my other looking forward
I'm glad
to.
You had a backup. I'm glad you
had
a backup.
I had one ready, you know?
God damn it. That's amazing. Oh, my God. All right, that is going to do it for us today. Weirdly, it's also going to do it for us ourselves this week, but not for you. You should come back tomorrow, because we're going to have so much more on our favorite games this year, and apparently some that aren't our favorite games because they didn't make the cut. Thank you so much for being here, Patrick, Rob, and Danielle. Where can people find you in that order, Patrick?
At Patrick Lubick.
Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
Danielle?
At Danielle R.I. Also probably playing... Nier in the new year.
playing Nier over the new year. Yeah. New Nier,
baby.
Give me that new Nier.
Yeah, I want to know what that team's going to do next so bad. Follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Follow Waypoint at twitter.com/Waypoint. Over on Facebook at facebook.com/WaypointVice. Follow us at waypoint.vice.com for all of our year-end stuff. Come check out our Pantheon. Hey. Come check out our Pantheon. That's me flirting from one Pantheon to another, saying like, hey, let's come see our gods. We got the best gods. And you can also follow us over on twitch.tv/waypoint, where we're going to be doing some videos. And did any of the games we talk about today, did any of those wind up in a video? I don't think so. We did a bunch of good videos with a bunch of good games. So check those out. And those will also eventually go up on youtube.com/waypointvice. I don't know if they'll be up there day and date, but they will be embedded in videos or in posts over on waypoint.vice.com. So check those out. I think that's going to do it for us today. I'm going to go take lunch because it's 3 and I'm hungry. And we haven't
3
stopped.
Half-hour podcasts.
Yeah.
Just going to bang them out.
Yeah.
Is that what I said this morning?
Yep.
What are the
3 half-hour podcasts.
I did say this morning.
No way will this take anywhere near 4.
I said, yeah, we better be done by 4.
Yep.
And we are. We are.
Hey, we're
done
by 4. I'm happy.
All right, everyone.
Sadly, you said that at 11:30 in the morning.
I fucking listen. We all have big mouths, and we all want to talk a lot.
We all got stuff to say.
We do. All right, everyone. That's going to do it for us. Tune back in tomorrow. Until then, Danielle, let them know.
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.